There's not a single problem in your company that exists today that writing a check can't make go away. So if you had more revenue, you can buy your way out of any problem. So the first key hires I hire are people that generate more revenue. I don't think entrepreneurs charge enough. Why don't you charge at the top 10% in your industry and look what will happen to your margins that you can then use for more marketing and hiring better people? That's one of the lies that entrepreneurs say, is that I have to do this. Again, if you want to get to that exit potential, your opportunity is to start delegating everything except genius, getting everything off your plate.
I wanted to start today just by saying thank you for listening. When we first started this show, we had one simple goal of professionalizing this industry. But more importantly, I wanted to give all of you a bit of your life back as entrepreneurs. And I never could have imagined we would have reached this many people. We've had our ups and downs, but man, have we learned so much about what actually brings value to this industry and how we could bring the change that so many of us are working towards. So my ask for you today is simple. It's to subscribe. It's the one free thing that you can do to help drive momentum in everything that we've been working on. So if you get value from this show and you believe in what we've set out to go do, I encourage you to subscribe and be a part of helping us reach this entire industry. Thank you. You're listening to Contract Revolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy, where we systemize contracting businesses for growth. Keep listening to learn how the world's top contractors scale their companies, build killer teams, and make more while working less. Mr. Cameron Harold, welcome back to the show. You are becoming a regular here. Thanks for coming on, my friend.
Thank you. It's good to see you again.
We just were hanging out in Cabo. You had quite the speech. For those who missed it, we'll speak a little bit today on it. But thank you for being there. I think you inspired a lot of us. And if nothing else, just really got to see, like, from a leadership perspective, from a systems perspective, what it takes to really grow an organization over time. So I'd love today to get deeper into that.
You know what? It takes a long time to get to the night before you become an overnight success story.
It just happens, doesn't it? You just click a few buttons and all of a sudden you're a success, no?
But I think there's something really important there for everybody to remember, that it really is a journey that we're going through. We have to enjoy the journey and we have to grind it out at times. We got to work smart and not get frustrated on that journey. I think so often entrepreneurs measure ourselves against the horizon. Like, I'll be happy when I get there. Or we measure ourselves against a brand like a 1-800-GOT-JUNK, or, you know, like what College Pro Painters used to be, or, like, you know, you can't measure against somebody who's been doing it forever. You know, I had someone the other day say, I just want to be like 1-800-GOT-JUNK. I'm like, do you know that Brian started that in 1989 and you weren't even born?
You know what I've been thinking about this? I've been working very hard to build something in this BTA business that we have. And I've been cautious to set too many hard expectations about the result that comes from that hard work. And I don't know if that's like a wimpy thing to do, but I just find, like, when things go well, it's all good. But when things don't, and I had a hard expectation on something, I feel remorse. And I'm just like, I don't want to feel remorse.
I think it's good to have goals and to have the journey that you're going on. Yeah. Like, I'll use an analogy that 10 years ago, one of the big things on my bucket list that had been there since I was probably 20 was to run a marathon. And I wanted to run a marathon before I was 50. And on my 50th year, I ran a marathon. And I also had a goal. I wanted to run a 4:30 marathon. And I really wanted to get, you know, if I could do sub 4 hours, that would have been amazing. But I knew that was probably unrealistic. But then I also was like, just don't be over 5. Like, I don't want to be one of those guys where I didn't really, you know, like, you're not running a marathon. You're just getting through the 26.2 miles. So I ran, I worked hard at it. I trained, I practiced, I got to the starting line. My training partner had a sore hip and, you know, it rained like crazy and I got a 4:25 marathon and I was super happy. But I also enjoyed all 26 miles.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember the journey. I remember the course. I remember some of the people on the sidelines. I remember the sights that I saw along the way. I took it all in. So I think it's important to have that goal, but also to enjoy that whole journey.
Yeah, maybe the right way to look at it is like, you don't put all the value in the result you're trying to achieve. Put a part of it in because that's the goal, but also put a lot of value in what you're doing along the way to get there.
Well, and you know why that is as well? Have you ever, you know, when you see the horizon, when you're driving a car and you see the horizon in the future?
I mean, I see the mountains. I live in the West Coast, but yeah, yeah.
Well, slightly different, but because you can get to the mountain.
Yeah.
But when you're driving a car and you're looking at the horizon kind of keeps moving, yep. Right? Or you get to the mountain, but then you see the next mountain.
Sure.
So if I'm going to be happy when I get to that last mountain, well, there's never a last mountain. And I think so often we're so trying to drive towards the horizon, but we forget that we keep setting new goals. We forget that we keep building the business bigger. You know, even when I was building 1-800-GOT-JUNK 19 years ago, I left the organization. My goal was to get it to 100 million. Now they're at 950 million. But they're not stopping at a billion. Elon won't stop at a trillionaire. He'll be worth 2 trillion. It's crazy to even think this.
Yeah, I know. it is a really like sobering reality to know that, especially as an entrepreneur. I think some people, like private equity, is entering our space a lot right now, and people are kind of like, okay, like I'm going to build this and I'm going to sell it. And I'm like, cool. Like I'm not saying you shouldn't. I'm just like, do you know what you're going to do next? Because I've heard other people describe it as like the desert, where they're just like, I don't know where I am or what to do next. I've sold all the things that brought me substance along the way. If a sale or an acquisition is a part of the plan and you're going to move to the next thing, that's cool. But I think the sobering reality that, especially I've been in my own business since I was 19 years old, almost 20 years now. And I'm realizing like, this is me. This is like who I am. And I don't think I could retire from this because I'm going to get all lethargic and weird. And whether it's this business or another business, but it's something that brings me life. And to your point, it's like, I need to make sure I actually enjoy it before I just kind of like put all my stock into just trying to get this thing to the end result.
Yeah. And I think that's where we have to enjoy the journey and remember that destination is important to drive towards. The other one is to remember that sometimes if you put all of your hopes and dreams on something and it doesn't happen, that can kind of ruin your entire reality up to and even past that point. You know, a goal might be to sell the company, but that never used to be a goal for entrepreneurs until about 30 years ago.
Mm. Yeah.
Most entrepreneurs, and I'm talking about empirical data as well as like, you know, but most entrepreneurs started a company and built a company and extracted wealth from that company and invested that and maybe passed it on to their children, or maybe just when they died, they shut her down. The goal was never to build for an exit. The goal was to build something for the sake of building it and to enjoy that journey and to have cash and free time. And I think too many entrepreneurs are so focused on building a company for an exit when they don't even know what they would do when they get to an exit.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
And I think that's really, really, I think that's very sad. Like the reason that most people can never retire is they have no freaking hobbies.
Yeah.
They have no life. You know, they have nothing that they're interested in other than building no one should really be that focused on my entire existence is my business to build to an exit. Cause then it's like hitting a brick wall. What are you going to do after your exit then?
I speak about this a bit, but it's like we've all found paths to getting dopamine. And so our business becomes the major supplier of dopamine, all the goals we have.
And that's a very North American centric thing.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. You live overseas a little bit too. So
yeah, I've been on the road for almost 5 years. I've been in 60 odd countries. You know, I think we need to get our dopamine from our hobbies, from our friends and family, from our passions, some from work, but work should not be the center of our entire universe. And again, I go back to this. Why are we so focused on building a company for an exit? What are you going to do with that money when you get to an exit? Have you got tax planning and strategies in place for when you have your, let's say you sell your company for $20 million. Well, are you prepared to pay the 50% or 30% capital gains? Do you have like a shelter set up? Do you know what you're going to do in an investment? What are you going to do with the next 40 years of your life? Like, and what if you don't get there? You know, what if you only sell for a third of that, right? What if the market collapses? I don't know. I think it's very dangerous that people are trying to build to an exit all the time versus have that as one of the goals, but also building a company to give them a better life, to give them better freedom, to give them more wealth, so that the journey is really valuable. And at the end of that journey, there might be another pot at the end of that rainbow. But if all they're chasing is the pot at the end of the rainbow, they miss the whole rainbow.
All right. So with that sobering thought, what I want to talk to you about is building a business as an asset. And let's keep this in mind as we go through this, because it isn't just about getting that done. It's about doing this with substance and meaning along the way. And the reason I want to talk about this is I do feel like it's like the hot topic right now. Down in the States, especially, there is a ton of private equity buying up, specifically actually roofing. I'm watching a lot happen, but they're moving into other, you know, verticals. And everyone's very excited by this idea. And I'm like, hey, cool. Like, let's do this, but let's do this with some meaning and substance and intentionality along the way.
That's all I'm saying too.
Okay. Yeah. So let's get into this. So first, I would just love to know this contracting space we're in. I know you've been in it for a long time. Go ahead.
Let me kind of double click on that for a second. One of the best ways that an entrepreneur will ever build a company to an exit, to a very successful, meaningful, valuable exit, is if they can build a company that can run without them.
Mm-hmm.
If you can delegate everything, if you can ensure that you've got good people in place and good plans in place and good SOPs in place and good marketing and branding so that your business can literally operate without you. And sure, you might come in and work on a couple of areas that your unique ability are that fire you up. But if you can build a company that can literally operate without you and that flywheel is going, you'll get a much higher economic value on when you sell your company than if you build a company that needs you day to day. But if your entire identity is because of you running a company, you're probably not going to get the exit that you want.
And you know what I think
it's almost counterintuitive.
I think that sounds like everybody, but I think everybody's trying to get freedom. And they're kind of like, if I systemize the business and I can make some money, then I can be free. And I'm like, yes, maybe, but like every business you systemize, you want the option to work in. I wouldn't say you want to everyone wants to exit. When I talk to a lot of our members, like, I still want to work in the business day to day. I just want the option to not have to. And what you're talking to is like, let's build a bit of an asset that works with or without me. And then I can make choices. Do I sell it? Do I keep it? Do I have it as a cash flow? Do I just work within it? And how do we do that properly is what we should talk about today. Sound good?
Okay.
So let's start with this, with the issues, which is like, I watch a lot of people talk about this and very few actually do it properly. When you're in a, let's talk in like the $1 to $10 million range is where I see a lot of the people I work with. Where do we get stuck? Where do most of our contractors kind of screw this up right out of the gates? And where do they get like plateaued along the way?
Well, one is that they don't delegate and they tend to tell themselves the lie that, you know, I need to do this. I'm the only person that can do this. I can get a better result that if I do this, that, you know, it needs to get done and I'll just work harder and I'll crank through this or I'll get through this. Well, that's possibly true. But again, if you want to get to that exit potential, your opportunity is to start delegating everything except genius, getting everything off your plate. So if you can look for ways to, you know, whatever you're working on that is so important or so impactful right now, can you pick somebody in your company that you can delegate that to? And then can you train that person? Can you give them the confidence and the skills and maybe the connection so they can actually do it without you? That's going to get you to that, you know, that goal faster. So that's one of the lies that entrepreneurs say, is that I have to do this. I think another one is that we drive towards perfection. You know, there's really a couple of types of entrepreneurs. One are the very, very smart people who were really, really good in school. And they're the, you know, the engineers, the, you know, Igor would be a very good example of this, right? Did very well in school, very, very particular, very detail oriented. Whereas the other, I was the opposite one. I was the one who failed at everything in school. So I'm okay with failure, and I'm also okay with good enough being out the door, like momentum creating momentum. I think something that can hurt entrepreneurs is that they try to have everything perfect. So it's this perfectionism, and it kind of leads into procrastination. That all, like, I have a friend right now who's been writing his freaking book for 3 years. I have put 2 books out in the 3 year period. And I guarantee you that nobody's going to read his book to the level of detail and blood and sweat and tears. He's put thousands of hours into this book. People are going to listen to it on 1.35 speed on Audible, you know, or they're going to have Grok or ChatGPT summarize it into a 2-pager for them. Like, nobody needs perfect. They just need it done and out the door faster. And I think entrepreneurs miss on that point.
How do you do that? Because like,
let me give you one last one.
Okay. I got questions on this after, but yeah.
I don't think entrepreneurs charge enough. Mm. I think so often I was talking to a client, actually he's a former BTA member or a BTA member, who is charging 10% less than the average in his industry. I'm like, dude, why are you driving revenue and charging less than average? Why don't you charge at the top 10% in your industry? And look what will happen to your margins that you can then use for more marketing and hiring better people and giving more free. But they're so nervous about charging more and charging. And I don't know where that comes from, but I think that's a third issue that they struggle with.
I think we get comfortable. is ultimately what happens. And this is kind of what you're speaking to, delegating to driving, you know, basically towards perfection and to charging more. It's like we get comfortable with what we actually have found success in initially, and we don't want to move the needle too much because that's what helped us get to where we are. We controlled everything.
I think there's comfort. I also think that the pricing one might be tied to, we understand how, like, I charge $40,000 for a speaking event. I used to be like, that's crazy. It's crazy. Like, it's just me on stage for an hour. That's crazy. So I would diminish the value of what I was giving. And then I realized that my $40,000 is because I've been building businesses for 40 years. My $40,000 is because I have to prep for the event, do a prep call, customize my slides, pack my bags, travel to an airport, sit at an airport, take the flight, get to the hotel, have dinner with the people from the event because they want to meet with me, do a sound check in the morning, get ready a half hour before my event, do my event, do all the book signings and talk to everybody, go to the cocktail party that'll be fun to go to, wake up in the morning, go back to the airport, sit on a flight, go home. Like, that's 3 days of my f-ing life to earn the $40,000. I'm like, wait, that's way less than my effective hourly rate is. But because, so I think we often do that as entrepreneurs, right? Like, how could I charge you $1,000 to paint your house when I know I'm only paying the guys $150?
Yeah.
So we forget how to attach value to a bigger price. Like, even at 1-800-GOT-JUNK, I wish I didn't still bring up examples from 19 years ago, but we'll charge a customer $500 and we take all their stuff and put it in a truck and we leave. We don't even give them anything. We're taking it away. They're left with nothing. So
how do you work with a lot of, you know, entrepreneurs, you work a lot of COOs, and yeah. I feel like what we're talking about even is like, these are people's limiting beliefs. Like, I can't properly delegate. Yeah. I have to do this all myself. I can't let this go without it being perfect. I see this for those who know Igor, it's like, that's just like his thing. And like, we all have that person in our business. Maybe some of that's us. So we can't let go, or I don't want to charge more. I'm not comfortable with this. These are limiting beliefs. How do you work through this with people? Where have you seen the biggest success? Because I feel like these are all known things. Like, we could speak all this on the podcast. People have heard this 100 times, but how do you move past these things?
One is benchmarking yourself against the top 10% in your industry, right? Like, if I'm going to open up a coffee shop and I'm going to have really nice espressos and really nice lattes and flat whites and nice pastries, I should go and visit 50 coffee shops in the city. And by the way, Starbucks kind of sucks. Starbucks is kind of average now. I remember when I went to the first Starbucks I ever went to in 1993 in Seattle, and it blew my mind because it hadn't even expanded outside of Seattle yet. But now Seattle's horribly average. You can go to tons of great hipster coffee places and have like great experiences and good pastries. And so and I look at what they're charging. I'm like, oh my God, you charged me $7 for a latte. And then I go to another place that charges me $7.50 for a latte, and I tip them 18% at the till because they blow me away and they have great jazz and they have great pastries and it's a cool vibe and an energy. And I'm like, wait, how did I just pay $9 for a coffee? So I want to benchmark myself against them. If you're in the house painting or you're roofing or you're doing landscaping or building fences or whatever you are, go benchmark yourself against the best in your industry, like the Tommy Mello with A1 Garage Doors, and benchmark yourselves against other industries. Like, become the FedEx of junk removal, or the FedEx of coffee, or the FedEx of house painting, right? So I think you have to go and look at, you know, what do the best restaurants do? What do the best hotels do? And then how can you build that into your business and charge accordingly? I think that's probably an opportunity for many entrepreneurs to do that. We often get very myopic and look at just our industry, mm-hmm. and we look at the average in our industry.
Right.
Like, if you benchmark your health against the average American is fat, yeah. like obese, right? If you like walk into a US airport and you notice it, like the average American is not healthy. I want to benchmark myself against the healthy people 10 years younger than me.
Yeah.
So I benchmark myself against healthy 50-year-olds. Not against the average American. So if my doctor says, oh, your testosterones are good, they're about average, I'm like, dude, that scares me. I want my, right? You have to do your business the same way. So I think that's one way to change your confidence level, is to give yourself new goals and new perspectives. The other one is definitely to invest in some masterminds and some coaching. I think it's very important for entrepreneurs to be in mastermind communities like BTA, like Genius Network, where you surround yourself with other entrepreneurs. I'm just off an event with 48 entrepreneurs. We went cat skiing up in the BC mountains. I was with Dan Martell and 47 other entrepreneurs for 4 days. My vibration is way higher. My network is way higher. I was there with guys that have sold their companies for $200-300 million. One of the guys was raising $2 billion before we went cat skiing that morning. So because I put myself in an environment with other successful people, it's like you're the average of the five people you spend the most time with. That helps entrepreneurs too.
I mean, this is the next topic I want to get into is around vision, but you're kind of speaking to the fact that like you need to have your eyes on the right prize. Like you need to see visually and understand what that actually looks like. And you can't bullshit your brain around it. It's like, I can try and say I'm going to do all these things. I could even, like you said, benchmark against what's out there, but until I'm close enough and actually see the innards and outards of it and talk to somebody about it, my brain won't fully buy into it. And I'll keep resorting back to where I feel safe.
Correct.
Okay.
You know, you heard the adage that you're the average of the five people you spend the most time with. Mm-hmm. I think that's why being in masterminds and having coaching, like when you have a coach, your coach will tend to benchmark you against others that they're working with. I also think it's important to have like everyone, let's say that you're in the roofing space. I think it's important that you be in a community like BTA, which is for the home services contractors, that like that's a very kind of niche or business to consumer home services sector. And then I think it's important that you join the Genius Network to be with all these other random entrepreneurs from all other industries. And then I call it ideas having sex, right?
Right.
You're getting inspiration and ideas and connections because
make a love
you
child.
Take a couple of ideas from Genius Network and a couple ideas from BTA, and all those ideas merge together and they have an idea baby. It's like that, you know.
That is a gift of an entrepreneur, is to see and understand patterns in multiple areas. And I think that, yeah, you're right in that. Can I ask you a question on this? Because I this is just Danny Kerr's belief. So I don't know if yeah. I'm like right in this. You can call me out on this. In this concept of surround myself with the five people that I most like want to become in my future or whatever it is, I've struggled to say that, yes, all five should.
I didn't say that,
okay,
by the way.
Okay, good. Thank you, because that's where
I said you're the average of the five people you spend the most time with. I didn't say to surround yourself with the five that you want to become.
Thank you. Okay, so this goes to my thought, and maybe I just clarify this with me. I have some really good friends from one when I was 3 years old, one when I was 13 years old, one when I was 18 years old. They're close to me. Now, they are not in a business. They're not doing anything that has to do with successes like the business world would describe it as. They're contractors, actually, for the most part, and I get along with them so well, and they ground me for who I am every single day. Amazing. I also have my business side. I have the people that I work with in BTA. I have my business partners. Yep. I have, people I meet in these podcasts, and it inspires me. And I find it's like having that dichotomy, like having that contrast. I have a motley crew of like people in my life, and I'm so happy for it. And
well, I think that's really good. I think it's good to have, I spend a lot of time with my family,
mm-hmm.
but my family doesn't necessarily raise my economic value, but they might raise my connection as a human. They might raise my ability to handle conflict, to have better communication, to just slow down. That's powerful. Then I have my group of people that I love to travel with. You know, those people raise my excitement and energy and passion to do bucket list stuff. Then I have my group of people that are, fitness, right? That I play paddle with, or that I go hiking with, or that I go cat skiing with. Like I have that group of, I have a friend who literally every time he sees me goes, did you take the stairs? Like he's in my athletic friend group. I don't sit and talk business with him much. We talk about family and sports and, that kind of stuff. But I think it's important that all entrepreneurs at least try to spend time with people that raise their vibrations in all energy of their life. You know, you're in shape. You probably have friends that you go to the gym with, or that you talk about fitness with, or that you do, fitness related things with.
Right. Yeah. Right? Faith, family, fitness, finances, and friends.
Correct.
This is Danny's.
So it's almost like who are your five people in each of those five Fs?
Right. There's a lot of them. Yeah. Right? And they make
but
up.
Often,
the, go ahead.
But often people don't think of that.
Right.
So they're only people like, I used to see people at conferences, business conferences. I'm like, why are you spending time at that event with the three negative people?
Mm-hmm.
avoid the negative people. Go spend time with, if you're at the conference, spend time with the ones that are growth minded, spend time with the ones that have other hobbies. Like, but people aren't as intentional with their time. And then the other one is, it's okay to fire people from your life once in a while.
Yeah.
You know, it's okay to get rid of people that don't live your core values or are too focused on just one area of their life to the detriment of others. Like I have a couple friends who their entire world is their sport.
Right.
To the detriment of their relationship of their kids. I don't want to be in their vortex that I'm just doing triathlon 7 days a week. I actually really value my relationship with my children. So I'd rather be with a bunch of dads or parents, moms and dads, who are healthy and active and traveling and so focused on raising kids too. Does that make sense?
It does. And this is the well-roundedness that I'm always fighting for. I'm always just like, I don't want to just have an amazing, I don't want to be Danny the businessman. I want it to be a part of who I am. And I want it to be a part of the vision of my future. But I'm also going to be Danny, the 60-year-old guy sitting on a whatever podcast with some other young guy one day. And I want to be able to have life experience beyond just the business that I operated in. And that's just me. That's my values. I want to get into this next stage, which is we're talking about getting inspired to kind of see what actually is possible so that you can set your targets. And we're talking about it being well-rounded beyond just even the business owner or in the business itself. You talk a lot about vivid vision. You've done a podcast with us on this in the past. And there was a really interesting question when you were speaking around like how clear this vision needs to be and what it doesn't need to be. And there's a couple other ones I'm going to come up that came up in the audience when we were at Winter Summit. But can you just speak to that? Like, how clear does your vision need to be? Because some people are hesitant to write it all out because like, I don't fully see it yet. I'm still trying to get inspired. I'm still trying to craft it. And they wait.
So the vivid vision becomes a 4 or 5 page description of what every single aspect of your company looks like, acts like, and feels like in the future. Ideally, you want to come up with 3 or 4 sentences or 3 or 4 bullet points for each major area of your company. So come up with 3 or 4 points to describe your marketing, 3 or 4 points to describe sales, 3 or 4 points to describe operations, 3 or 4 points to describe your interaction with customers, 3 or 4 points to discuss, you know, employees and how they work together, some points about metrics, some points about your leadership team, some points about how you work with suppliers and subcontractors, some points to talk about how your company lives core values. If you have 3 or 4 points about all of those major areas and influence on your company, that's enough. That's perfect enough. I think what people are saying is they're giving themselves an excuse to not do the work and not get it out of their head by I can't get the perfect vision, so I just won't have one. Mm-hmm. Well, then stop complaining about how hard it is to align all of your employees because they have no idea where you're going.
Right. Do you do this first or do you do the personal one first? Because I've found it over time, like I'm driving towards my business goals and along the way, I'm like sacrificing myself to do it. How do you balance those two?
So I didn't understand that you could use the vivid vision for your personal life until I was about 6 years into my business because I had a problem. I was really boring. And my entire world was my business.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
And I hit 42 years old, 2007, and I went to my first Burning Man, and my world exploded, and I went, I forgot what I was doing when I was 21. Mm-hmm. When I was 21, I was running a business and playing golf and windsurfing and playing tennis and skiing and drinking and chasing girls and listening to music, and I had so many other things in addition to running my company that over time I let all those things fall away. So I wrote my first vivid vision for me as a human. And I wrote about what are my relationships like? How am I showing up as a dad? How am I showing up as a friend? How am I showing up in my community? How am I showing up? And what am I doing for my vacations? What am I doing for fun? What am I doing for activities? What am I doing to stay in shape? How am I using psychedelics for growth? How am I growing sexually? What am I doing to have more work-life balance or work-life integration? So I think when I started to think about all of those things, it started to build a better me, right? And then I started, then I did one with my wife. And so my wife and I then wrote A Vivid Vision for Us as a Couple, right? How do we communicate? Mm-hmm. How do we break up roles and responsibilities? How do we stay on the same page? How do we have time apart? How do we grow together sexually? How do we solve problems? What do we do for fun? Where are we traveling? What are our bucket lists? So my wife and I wrote a 5-page description of us. We wrote our vivid vision as a couple. So I if I was to do it now, I would say write your vivid vision for you as a human first, mm-hmm. then write your one for you as a couple second, and then run for your business third.
Cool. I've not done the couple one. That's interesting.
It's really powerful. You want to know why you grow apart? It's because you don't have a shared vision of what you're growing towards.
Yeah. You know what? Actually, we did that in marriage counseling before we got married. So it's part of our process. Great. And we got to identify where we're... Anyways, and since then, we haven't. And so we've been living in silos. She's been mom with 3 kids, busy, busy, busy. Danny's been business guy, trying to make a bit of time to go off-roading and do some little things on the side. And it's just like, yeah, there is... And we still love each other, but you're right. It's like, it's not as... It's passionately like driven as it used to be. So
yeah, it's a cool opportunity to kind of recalibrate that a little bit.
My wife will listen to this and we will do this. okay. So we're talking a bit about vision here. There was a question in the audience and I thought it was a valid one. He said, man, what if you're so stuck in the weeds and you're just disconnected and you don't even know what your vision is? I'm wondering, even as we're talking, is it because
they don't know
why they're doing what they're doing anymore? I assume, like, how do you bring that back? Is it about starting with the personal why first? Like, what are your thoughts on that? Because I remember that question. It struck me.
No, it's really about the reason you're stuck is you're probably thinking about vision and sitting in a chair where you're always solving problems and looking at the reality and time managing and dealing with email. And like, so it's hard to think creatively when you're stuck in the day to day. So what I do, if I wanted to work on my personal or my business or my family vivid vision, is I close my laptop. I put this on top of it and I grab a notebook and a pen and I leave and I go somewhere where I'm around nature. When I wrote my very first vivid vision for my company, I smoked a joint. I went into my backyard. Cannabis is legal in British Columbia. I went into my backyard. I lay in the hammock. I put some headphones on and I listened to the Grateful Dead. And I literally just mind mapped every aspect of my business. So it was easy for me to disconnect from the world because I didn't have any of my business around me. You know, I gave myself the space and the time and the setting to allow myself to dream.
This leads to my next thought and question around this, which is, sounds great. And I think some of us and all of us could probably...
And you can have some good vivid visions on cannabis.
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie. Like, I get it. It opens up a creative part of your brain. Those who use it, it's all good. But like, I think that's momentary. I think there's, you know, and I allow for it too. It's like I allow for space to be creative and be playful and think outside the box. But then I have to go right back in to the hardcore operations. And you can write it out, but you can just disconnect it from it even along the way. And this was my next question around just like getting out of the day to day and how do we maintain that structure in our business and operations as we move forward.
Think about what Thomas Edison said, you know, the inventor of the light bulb. He said that vision without execution is hallucination.
Yeah.
So you can't just write a vivid vision and expect it to come true.
Totally.
You have to share your vivid vision with all of your employees, with all of your customers, with all of your shareholders, with your marketing partner, with your lawyer, with your accountant. You share it with your spouse and your friends and family. So everybody can see what your company looks like and feels like in the future. And then every quarter, you have everyone reread it. Well, if people are always rereading their vivid vision, they're thinking about the future, but they're executing on today. And that's kind of the key that people need to remember is our role is to be cognizant of where we're going and to be figuring out how we're actually going to be making it true on that day-to-day basis. So rereading it every quarter and then getting back in and grinding it out and working and then getting all your employees to reread it every quarter.
Is there an evolution of the individual that needs to happen? Because I feel like it doesn't happen overnight. It's not just like go and start delegating everything and be like the commander of your ship. It's like you're still in the weeds. what are some of the like the low-hanging fruit or the things that we can start to do when we're, say, at 1 to 2, maybe 3 million, we're trying to grow to 10, we're at that stage in business to create space for vision, to create space and time for leadership that's at that higher level while still having to go operate in at least a couple of these roles?
Delegate everything except genius.
What do you mean by that? Explain what you mean.
I mean, when I was running my first operational company, house painting company, I had 12 employees. And, you know, we were painting 6 houses at the same time. I couldn't be out painting house one because then I'd be avoiding the other 5 houses. I also didn't like to paint. I was also really scared of heights. So I delegated all the painting responsibilities. And I also didn't love dealing with customers that much. I found having to walk around the house and chat about their day, and because there's too much else going on in my brain, that I decided to delegate everything except strategy and planning and hiring and culture. That's all I did, you know? And then I did sales because I was really good at like landing the jobs. But as soon as I landed it, I passed it off to a foreman who managed the client and collected the check and did the, you know? So I think in your business, if you want to free up time to be strategic or free up time to be visionary, you've got to delegate everything except genius. You've got to find people to delegate it to and give them the skills and the confidence and connections so they can do those things. And then free up your time to do your things. You know, if you only had, as an example, like let's just play like a scenario with your business today. If Danny only had 2 hours a day to work, what would you do in those 2 hours a day? If the others 22 hours a day, you were literally couldn't do anything.
In my current state, because Igor is doing a lot of our operations, which is nice. But in our current state, I think a lot of it is around the initiatives that we currently have in place and how they connect to what we're currently operating, like the current operations. It's like all these
so it'd be like strategy and planning, right? You'd be thinking about where we're going and all the pieces all together.
You know what it is? It's pattern recognition. It's seeing all the opportunities that exist in today's world and seeing where we want to go as a company and trying to really understand where that like triple threat win is and where that like unique relationship can be built or where that, and following up on those things and not just letting them be ideas on a chalkboard, right?
And by the way, that's strategy.
Right.
You know, it's weird that people talk about strategic planning. There's no such thing as strategic planning. There's strategy and there's planning. Mm-hmm. They're different. Once you have strategy, which is what you love to do, then you need to get the people to put the plans in place to make the strategy happen. People, you, if you had the best 2 hours of your, like you would love to do that all day long. Well, your business would excel even faster if you could get everything else off your plate so you could do that 8 hours a day.
What if you're super ADD and you have tons of strategies all the time and they are constantly conflict with people's ability to go execute?
Well, it gives you time to think about them and to flesh them out a little bit and to understand them more and to figure out which ones are the highest ROI and which ones require the lowest PETA, the pain in the ass factor, right? Which ones require the least amount of people, time, and money? Which ones could be automated? You'll have more time to think about all of the things before you just delegate them. What ends up happening now as entrepreneurs is we have all these ideas and we're so rushed that we end up starting stuff too quickly because we don't give ourselves the 8 hours a day to think.
If you
didn't have all the other meetings and all the other stuff on your plate, like even interviewing me, like that's something that may or may not be in your wheelhouse of unique ability. I think you're really good at it, but it may not be something that fires you up and you love to do. Right. Or maybe you pull ideas from this, which allows you to come back in strategically. So, but if 8 hours a day, all you did was stuff related to strategy, you wouldn't be quick starting a bunch of random ideas that don't connect together, don't fit together as well.
And you know what's interesting about that is I feel guilty if I give myself that much space.
Of course.
Yeah. And so it's
because we have to be doing the other stuff that we suck at because the school system and the church messed us up.
Yeah.
The school system and the church made us feel guilty. The school system told us, if you suck at something, go get a tutor and work harder. What the school system should have said was, hey, Danny, you're terrible at X. Don't ever study it again. Don't ever look at it again. Don't ever worry about it. Don't get a tutor. We'll give you a straight A on that class, but just don't show up. But you're really good at this course. Just do that.
Yeah.
What was your most favorite class in school?
Actually, funny enough, woodworking. I created a cabinet that took me a year to build, and I custom designed it, and it was the most incredible. I still have it in my office, actually, to this day.
Isn't it great?
It's so cool.
I was terrible at woodworking, but I made a bowl, and I gave the bowl to my dad, and then when my dad died, I got the bowl back, and it's this wood carved. I did it with a lathe. It was magic watching, and I made a chessboard, and I'm really bad at chess, but I still have the chessboard. So I made the board and the pieces in woodworking class. But you know what I was told to do? I was told to go to French class and get a French tutor. I was told to go to chemistry class and get, do you know how hard it is for me to memorize chemistry and biology? Oh my God, these words are so long. But why didn't they say, you know what? You're really, really good at public speaking. You should just go do more speaking. You're really good at debate. You should go do more debate. No, they said, go get a tutor at stuff you're bad at. So in the business world, we tend to feel guilty about not doing the stuff that feels easy because we're preconditioned to try to do the stuff that feels hard.
This goes back.
Business doesn't have to. Look at the way you live in British Columbia. You know, when you see water running down a mountain, it doesn't take the hard path down.
Yeah.
It follows the easiest path down to the bottom. And I think we need to do that more as entrepreneurs and be okay that the easy path is the smart path.
We have to trust in our abilities. And it's just like, this feels like I probably shouldn't, but you're right. We need to spend more. Okay, that's good. That's fair. And that's a good call out even for me. So
even my newest business book is called Grandmother's Business Secrets, because it's all of the business systems that we need. Grandma was telling us this stuff. Right. But we overcomplicate it. And we think we need an MBA to run a company.
That is the feeling. As things get bigger, you feel the responsibility and the weight of, this should be more advanced, this should be more, and it feels complicated. And I am questioning that, actually, as things get bigger. Is complexity really required? And why did we keep thinking it is? And in some areas, I think it is. You could call me out if it's not. But in other areas, I'm worried. I'm like, this doesn't feel right. This doesn't feel...
Look at how simple Elon Musk has made all of his business ventures feel. He focuses on the critical few things versus the important many. I heard him say about 6 months ago, if you're the entrepreneur and you don't know the one big problem to focus on in your company this week, you're the problem.
Right. Interesting.
So simple, right? Every week, find a big problem, work really maniacally hard on that one big problem. Next week, do the next problem. If entrepreneurs just did that, they would solve 52 major problems or launch 52 major opportunities or deal with 52 major threats. But we just end up being busy, being busy, being busy, checking email, checking Slack, checking shit. We're like ducks with our feet going like this under the water. And Elon's like, what's the one big thing I can be maniacal about this week?
Yeah. We just want to feel useful. We want to feel valued. And so we constantly put ourselves in this busy work. And I agree with you. And it's we're addicted to it. We're addicted to being busy, even if it's not productive. And it's, yeah, I personally get guilt from it. I'm sure a lot of people that do, but it's something that I'm aware of, and it's constantly having to remind myself to be different versus just like knowing it. I can know it all day long. It's a constant exercise.
Right. It's tough.
I want to talk about the other side of this, which is like, hey, okay, I want to go be this way. I want to give myself space to do this. Who do I need to hire along the way to make sure that the operations still go, some of the complexity is still managed and created into the organization? And yes, we can talk about project managers and a sales manager, and I think that's a part of the journey, but I think there's something more to this where it's like, who's the driver that's going to bring enterprise value to help bring this? Because I, as an entrepreneur, I constantly feel like anything that needs to be created net new, anything that's going to drive future value still relies on the entrepreneur. And there's got to be a solution through this, because it's been hard to even problem solve in our organization. It's us driving it. Is there a hire out there? Is there a person you bring in? You work with COOs all the time. Who is this?
So here's where I start. The key hires, the hires that make the biggest, easiest difference on your business are the sales revenue generating hires. Because the people that bring more revenue into your business, more gross margin into your business, there's not a single problem in your company that exists today that writing a check can't make go away. So if you had more revenue, you can buy your way out of any problem. So the first key hires I hire are people that generate more revenue. Revenue. I got so much revenue coming in the door, then I can build the better mousetrap. It's not about the better mousetrap. It's not about all the better SOPs, all the better systems. So I usually start with those people first, the revenue generating people first. Secondly, is I hire people that can do the stuff that I suck at or that I don't love to do. And they are really good at those things. I'm really bad at marketing. I'm good at being on a stage. I'm good at talking to media. I'm really bad at marketing, like at the details and design elements and marketing charts and calendars and budget. It's just too much for me. I hired this woman who is incredible. My VP of marketing. She literally is incredible at marketing and she loves it. She could spend all day on all the stuff that drains me and I suck at. So that's the second layer to hire, is those people that are experts at the stuff you're bad at. And then the last one is, and maybe this is probably second, would be to get an executive assistant, right? If you don't have an assistant, you are one, right? If you're running a company making $100,000 a year or $200,000 a year, that's $50 or $100 an hour. Why are you doing $10 an hour tasks or $15 an hour tasks, right? So I would get all the admin off your plate first.
Yeah, which goes along with like all the stuff you probably suck at. It goes into that, probably the same category.
Right.
So this is setting up the team. And this is allowing for, like you said, for revenue to be generated, for the operations to start to kind of flow without you needing to be in all the details, for someone to take off the administrative stuff. So that is to me like sales, production, and office admin. And I do see that as like the first middle layer you build. Is there a time in business when you start to say, it could be a GM? Is there a right time you start to put in someone who's actually going to drive all of that now forward with or without you? Or are you always going to be the one driving that ship?
No, you can end up hiring somebody who is better at project planning, better at priority management, better at growing people, better at aligning people, better at making sure details are in place. And that person can run your business. That's the second in command. That's the person. Like, at 1-800-GOT-JUNK, I was that for Brian, mm-hmm. right? Brian wasn't good at those things, so he hired me and I was able to do those things for him.
What stage in business is that? Like, is it about affording it? Is it about being conscious about the leadership structure you built, about your own ability to lead that person? Like, what's too early?
In the 1 to 3 or 3 to 10 million zone tends to be where you're hiring. Probably in the 3 million to 10 million zone is where you're hiring a true second in command. You need an executive assistant first. You need a second in command second. Okay. But I would go like sales, marketing people, executive assistant, more sales, marketing people, some project managers and people that can do a bunch of stuff. And then the expert who can oversee them and manage them all. Be careful that you're not just adding overhead that doesn't generate return on investment, right? You need each new person that you bring in has to generate at least 3 or 4 times their annual compensation in additional gross margin. So if I'm going to pay somebody $200,000, they have to at least generate $600,000 in more gross margin.
Not revenue, gross profit.
Is what you're, right. Okay. Don't raise your revenue. If you've got a 60% cost of goods sold, why would you ever return on ad spend or return on investment and measure revenue against that? It's always gross margin against that. Almost every company screws that up. You look at your contribution margin, not your revenue against your input.
So I'm basically like, okay, if I'm going to bring in this role for $200,000.
You know, let me give you an example of that.
Yeah.
If I said to you, Ryan, if you give me $1,000, I will generate $2,000 in revenue. That sounds pretty good, right?
Yeah.
But imagine if you had a 70% cost of goods sold, like you're selling furniture or you're selling, I don't know, whatever. You got 70% cost of goods sold. If I generate $2,000 in revenue for you, but you have a 70% cost of goods sold, that's $1,400 you had to spend. You're only left with $600. Now you spent $1,000 to generate $600.
I'm out.
You're going backwards.
Yeah.
I could put you out of business getting you a 200% return on ad spend.
And one thing I've noticed you're talking about is like, yes, add these roles in, but go drive sales as you do it. It's like sales again. Sales and then come back down to these to justify it.
Because the more revenue, if you can get that revenue flywheel going, again, look what Amazon did in the early days. Revenue. Like it wasn't about profit. It was revenue. Like the more, and then all of a sudden it was like, oh my God, you can't compete against, like nobody even tries to compete against Amazon.
The malls are super empty these days.
Yeah. Everyone opens another coffee shop or another junk removal business or another like mastermind community. Why doesn't, because they're destroying, they own it. But they didn't focus on perfect first.
Yeah. With these roles.
They didn't even focus on profits.
Yeah, fair enough. And so I'm getting the picture. And within these roles, Is there any common traits you see across these roles that you want to look for in people? Because a lot of people say, make sure everyone's aligned on core values, which I agree with. But is there anything else that's like you can miss on this? And if you have a key driver in one of these positions that doesn't have this trait, you're going to struggle.
You just said that everybody says, I'm going to paraphrase, okay. Everybody says that you should focus on core values, but is there anything else?
Yes. You can call me out, whatever it is. Is it just core values?
It's the only thing that matters. Okay. When you hire people who obsess about your company's core values, who already live your company's core values, who will go through brick walls for those company's core values, business gets simple.
Right.
It's that deep. That's all that matters to them. And they have the skills to do what you need. You'll win every race.
Right.
I remember in 1989 calling out my VP on being really rude to one of the women in my office, in our office. He was my boss. He was really rude. And I was like, Kevin, respect the individual. Our core values were respect the individual, deliver what you promise, pride in all you do. Yep. He basically broke two of them, respect the individual and pride in all you do. Mm-hmm. And I called him, I'm like, respect the individual. And he looked at me and he goes, don't ever f-ing call me on the core values. And he stormed out of the room. And I was like, I am totally getting fired today. He called me into his office about 20 minutes later. I closed the door and he goes, don't call me on the core values in front of the employees. And my response, and I don't know where it came from, was almost instant. And I said, then don't break them. Uh-huh. And he looked at me and he was like, he knew he was wrong. And there was nowhere to go. And he was looking in the mirror and he didn't like what he saw. That's the only thing that matters in scaling your company.
How do you identify that in people? I mean, there's the interview process. There's the ongoing working relationship. Is there any?
Well, no, it's all the interviewing. It starts with the interview, right? You know, you and I grew up Christian. So I don't know if you grew up Catholic, but in the Catholic Church, you go to church and then you go to confession and you sit with the priest and you say, hey, I did these bad things. And the priest says, okay, I forgive you. Go say these 10 Hail Marys and 3 Our Fathers and your sins have been absolved. Oh, and by the way, give me a donation for the church. Yeah. I realized back then that they didn't really care about the core values that much. They cared about the guilt that they left you with for breaking them, and they cared about getting more of your money. In my world, in the business, you don't keep breaking the core values. So I want to make sure that in the interview process, in the reference check process, we only hire people who already really live those core values.
How do you, I guess to go deeper on that question, how do you identify though? Because if I know ours is be real, genuinely care for people and embrace the journey.
Okay. So let's go with, what was the second one?
Embrace the journey.
Okay. So let's go into Grok and we'll say, do you follow?
Yeah, I do.
What 5 interview questions could I ask to see if someone lives the quote, embrace the journey. This is valuable to do this live.
I like it. Let's see journey, this.
Core value. And boom, let's see what it comes back with. And here are the 5 strong behavioral interview questions blast. First one is, tell me about a time or when a project or goal took much longer than expected or hit several roadblocks. And then the probing is, how did you respond? What kept you motivated, right? And then it shows you what to listen for. Next one is, describe a situation where you had to invest significant time and effort to get something without any guarantee of success and pay off. What was your mindset? It gives you all the probing. Yeah. That's where you go.
Yeah.
The biggest thing though here, and this is why it's even in my Invest in Your Leaders training course, is people need to be good at interviewing. Now we've got a cheat sheet. For anything you want to probe for, mm-hmm. Grok or ChatGPT can give you the shortcut. The skill though is, can I probe? Can I then ask the question? Can I shut up as the interviewer? Can I ask the question 3 times in a row? The same question. Can I ask the question and pause and count to 10 with my fingers under the table to have the pregnant pause? It's hard, right? If anybody's listening, they're like, did we just go to dinner? No, I was counting and I did a little bit faster. That's uncomfortable, but those are skills that people need to be good at. In addition to knowing what to ask, it's how to actually ask them, yeah. Right?
Yeah, and you know what else you just did, which is good for, I think, just people to hear, is core values, there's not like one way to interview for core values. They're your core values, and then what specific custom questions need to be asked to uncover those specific core values. I've heard it before where people are just looking for like, do they have good values? And I'm like, no, you're missing the whole point. Like there is no like universal question sequence for this. This is custom to you, which is, thank you for bringing up ChatGPT or Grok, because it will help that process, but it is always custom.
And this is why the culture of the person can be different, but the core values that matter to them will be the same. Let me explain. Our IT group at 1-800-GOT-JUNK was very Russian. They were all Russian. Our VP was Russian. He hired a couple of Russian coders. They hired a bunch of Russian people. Their culture was very different. They drank vodka. They had very strange humor. You'd look at them with a big frown on their face. I'm like, why are you unhappy? They're like, I'm not. I'm laughing. I'm like, dude, you look like you're going to kill me. Like, you're not laughing. But their culture was their culture, but their core values were absolutely the same as the sales team, who was gregarious, making it up, being funny, probably being a little bit crude, you know, just being these crazy out of the box random thinkers, but they lived the core values. So the core values is what holds the company together. They're not the same kind of person. Uh-huh. And I think people forget that. Your finance or accounting person will be different than your marketing person, but their core values can still be the same. The controller will still care about delivering what they promise, respecting the individual, having pride in all you do, finding a better way, as will the marketer.
And arguably, they have to be very different people because they have to do very different parts of the organization. And if they're all the same, you create a bunch of copies of yourself and it's very lopsided. And it's
like a husband and wife, frankly.
Yeah.
Men are not hairy versions of women.
No.
Right? You're not a mustached, goatee-wearing version of your wife. You see the world differently. You perceive the world differently. But you and your wife share the same core values to be able to then raise kids together. But you're a male and a female with very so the stuff that keeps us together is those things. But we're absolutely different.
Let's I've got one or two more questions for you, then we can wrap up. But just looking back at the entrepreneur for a second, I would love just to, from your perspective, from years of doing this, working with tons of people in this industry, what are the common patterns you see in the entrepreneurs that actually pull this off? They scale up a business, they pull out of the day-to-day, they've got a nice little asset that they can use, sell, duplicate, whatever they want to do with it. And those who talk about it a lot, but don't really ever make it happen.
It's the ones who are very focused. So it's the as Tom Peters, who wrote In Search of Excellence, said, it's about the monomaniac with the mission.
What is a monomaniac? Like
a soul focus.
Okay.
A monomaniac is a soul focused, maniacal soul focus, right? Like flywheel. And that monomaniacal soul focused obsession, that will get you to be successful. And then, yeah, that's probably it.
That's it.
Right?
Yeah.
That's it, man. That's because it allows you to say no. It keeps you hyper-focused. It keeps you excited. Like the only reason Elon can run all of these different companies, he didn't start them at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, his first company that he built and sold for $320 million was Zip2 prior to him joining Peter Thiel and doing PayPal.
Yeah.
Right? Prior to him acquiring Tesla that he was an investor in, prior to him starting SpaceX, prior to him starting Neuralink and the Boring Company. Like what he's done is he's made sure that he gets that maniacal focus around getting something up and going, getting the flywheel working, getting the people and the money and the team in place. And then he's got that flywheel going. And then while that flywheel is going, then he gets the second one going, right? But he doesn't try to do seven at the same time. And then what he does is he goes back to check in on some of those other companies in a very monomaniacal focused way to fix that one thing. Like right now, you can tell where his focus is at right now. His focus is on A, streamlining Tesla. Mm-hmm. He's no longer making the Model X and Model S.
Getting ready for robots.
And he's going hardcore into the robots. Right. So he's maniacally focused and merging X into Tesla. Like he's doing the things that are now car SpaceX. Like we can see where, and the other one I think is one of his maniacal focuses. I think he has this childhood need to be the very, and I understand it, to be the first trillionaire ever.
Right.
So he's like, how do I merge my companies together quick enough so I can be a trillionaire, you know? But it's because I just want to make sure that the entrepreneurs are clear that that maniacal focus, Elon is maniacally focused. Yes, he might have seven companies, but each one of those are already in orbit, right? Each one of those companies are largely, the flywheel is already turning.
And I think it's also knowing when to pivot your focus, because you can have that maniacal focus and just build the best, most, like you said, best mousetrap out there. And then that is it. And then you never move.
Well, that feeds your ADD, right? If you're an entrepreneur who's ADD, if you can go be maniacally focused around a marketing issue this week, mm-hmm. and then after a week get bored, now go maniacally focused around a sales issue. Oh, I'm bored after that week. I'll go maniacally focused around this business's thing. Cool. Yeah. Cool. But be that monomaniac with a focus, you know, on that one big thing.
As long as that focus is all pointing to your original point of like vivid vision in one direction,
Right. You don't want to, like, that's one of the biggest problems in the world is you can hire all the best people who are really, really hardworking, who are all living the core values, and they're all going to grind it out and they're going in the wrong direction. Well, that was pointless.
Yeah. I see a lot of people that just ideas. And every year they've got a new version of their business that they're trying out and I'm like, oh God, this is, yeah.
And they don't even know what direction they're going in.
Yeah.
So like they're riding, you know, they're driving the car as fast as possible. And all of a sudden they end up in Miami. They go, we did it. And you go, the goal was San Diego.
They tended to be focused on this new idea, but it's like this new way to make money almost. And then they're missing like the why behind it. They don't really understand
correct.
Why
well,
they're
focusing
it.
On that big shiny object,
yeah.
right? They get distracted by that next big thing without the core purpose, your why, without the vivid vision of where you're driving towards. I've even seen entrepreneurs that have blown up their family, blown up their relationships, blown up their bank account, blown up their health, but wow, they were a business success.
Right. Which is not success. I firmly believe, and I'm sure most of us could agree with that, but it's hard to see it when you're in it.
That's why it's almost a bit of a golden thread here. When they sell the company and then they have to look in the mirror the next morning and they hate their life.
We could finish on this, and I'll just give it one more thought. You were talking earlier about having that personal vivid vision and writing it out. One thing I would recommend anyone doing is starting with that. I had ChatGPT generate an old version of me, so like this old man version of me. And this was an exercise I was put through. I didn't come up with this, but I then had to write from my older self down to my current self about what the future is that I've built and the reality that I'd lived in and what my encouragement for myself and my just reaffirming, hey, I know you're here and I know you're trying to work on over this. This is what ends up happening for you in life. And I have to read that every once in a while to get realigned with all the different things that I'm doing every single day, because you go away to those retreats and you do those cool vision exercises and then you get back into the operational chaos and you start to just forget. But I think having it written and something that's not even just for your team, that's just for me. Like I read it. It brings me back to like a grounded reality. It's like, and
I love that
the statement in all of it actually that came out of it is, what if there was a better way? And I'm constantly looking at that because I unfortunately just am just like, anyways, I'm maniacal, but I get like too laser focused. So, and I just put my head down and go, let's wrap this up. Any just grounded expectations for people that are on this journey? They're in this range of 1 to 10 million. They're trying to build out something that's an asset. They really want to see that success in their life in the future. They're struggling and building and having fun and all the things in between. Just any thoughts for them? Grounded expectations, leaving this the end of this talk?
Back in 1986, Ronald Reagan was meeting with Mikhail Gorbachev. So Ronald Reagan was president of the United States. Mikhail Gorbachev was the president of the Soviet Union. And they were having an all-day summit meeting. And they were solving all the world's problems. The Berlin Wall was going to come down that following year. I guess it was 1996. And during the meeting, this guy had run in and was pissed off and ranting and raving. And Mikhail Gorbachev said, remember rule number 6. And the man laughed and walked out of the room. It happened 3 times during the meeting. Somebody upset, remember rule number 6. They started laughing and they walked out of the room. So Reagan's like, I need to know what rule number 6 is. You know, like they've literally solved the world's problems, but I need to know what rule number 6 is. And Mikhail Gorbachev said, rule number 6 is don't take yourself so effing seriously. Mm-hmm. And Reagan said, well, what are the first 5 rules? Gorbachev said, there aren't any. And I think that's always stuck with me as like, why does this journey have to be so serious? Mm. Right? Why can't we have fun along that path too?
That's amazing.
Because we're all going to die.
We're all going to die. And I think, you know, you're a little older than me, but the older you get, the more you start to realize that. I balance between these two, where it's just like,
look at Elon as our example role model, right? Or Richard Branson, right? Like Virgin Records, and he's out kiteboarding and having fun and playing games and long hair. And then Elon, do you know that the cars, the Model S, the Model 3, the Model X, the Model Y, which spells the word sexy.
Yeah.
And the original map of where the Tesla could drive on autopilot in Austin was the shape of a penis. He's just not taking himself so effing seriously. He could wear a t-shirt that says rule number 6.
It's to go out there and have a lot of fun. You know what's so interesting? When we were kids, this was easy. And then the world went and fucked us up a little bit and told us that
the
we need
school
to.
School and the church messed us up.
Right. It's getting back to that version of ourselves when we were younger, when we just didn't give a shit about anything. We were just having fun. I remember my sandbox, and I just be like, played in my sandbox.
Oh, great.
Have I told you about my young life? Man, it was chaos. My parents, there was all kinds of stuff going on. But I was surprisingly not that traumatically affected by it, because I had my sandbox and I had my friends and life was simple. And I had my Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles that I'd watch. I wanted to be a Power Ranger. And I was in the moment. And I think,
and you know what's fun is I would rather hear you talk about that stuff than what you do to make money.
Yeah, fair, right?
Same with you, right?
Yeah, it's the human side of us. It's the connection. It's
and
the real spark.
And it's remembering rule number 6. Let's have fun along this journey. Let's enjoy the journey. Let's enjoy all of these experiences we get to do. And let's build a really good company and sell it for an extraordinary amount of money.
And have fun all the way through that and all the way past that.
Exactly.
Cameron, that was great. Thank you for your time on all this. Thank you for coming out to Summit this year. That was a lot of fun to see you and meet you. And look forward to more chats in the future, my friend.
Well, let's get me back to Summit again, and I'll see you in the sandbox.
All right. I'll bring the troubles. Okay, buddy. All right. Talk to you
later.
Thanks,
man. Ciao.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Contractor Evolution. If you've already subscribed to our podcast, consider sharing this episode with another contractor that you think needs to hear it.